You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey, everyone. Before we get into this week's show, I just wanted to mention that this interview was recorded earlier in June before the Supreme Court's barbaric decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. You might be able to tell because in this episode, my voice isn't cracking and raspy like it is now from screaming in the street. We're sending love to abortion patients and providers, past, present, and future, especially those in states with trigger laws, women and people who can get pregnant, also BIPOC, LGBTQIA+, people with disabilities, immigrants, and social justice advocates. We're in solidarity with you in absolute rage and ultimately hope for a liberated future. We also did record this before we had finalized details for our Lilith Fair karaoke party, which will be this Saturday, July 2nd, 8 p.m. at Come On Everybody in Brooklyn. You can come funnel some of your rage into a feminist anthem. You can just show up dressed as your favorite Lilith Fair performer. Thanks to Maker's Mark, this event will be free. And also, so will the hugs. Okay, wow. Time to go rest my voice so that I can sing on Saturday. So let's dike out.
Before we get up the stairs, he goes, before we go up there, I just want to let you know, it's all lesbians. And I like panic. And my friend is like, oh, that's great. I love lesbians. And then it was like relief. I'm like, okay, I am safe with this person. Yeah. She will be the first one I come out to when I do come out.
I'm dyking out, you're dyking out. Let's dyke out together. See what it's all about.
Dyking out, dyking out, dyking out, dyking out.
Hi, and welcome to Dyking Out, the horse girl of podcasts. I'm Carolyn Bergier.
Speak for yourself. I'm Melody Kamali. And today we're dyking out with comedian Ellie Kremendahl.
Hi.
Ellie, are you a horse girl?
No, not in any way.
I'm not a horse girl either, but, you know, I feel like we should shout them out. They don't get a Pride Month, and we know you're here, you're queer, and let's celebrate them. So, horse girls, unite. Some quick announcements. June 30th, we will be at the New York Liberty Pride game, and you can get tickets through us. We have a special link, and you can sit with other Dyking Out listeners. Isn't that fun? Support the WNBA, support women in sports, pride, all that good stuff. Lastly, we have a Patreon. Ellie, why should people sign up for our Patreon?
Why not? What else are you doing?
Exactly.
Beautiful. Perfect answer. Great. Patreon.com/dykingout. Now we can get to the gay stuff. I feel like our announcements are gay. Everything's gay.
Everything's gay. Let's add on to that. Carolyn, what's the gayest thing you did this week?
The gayest thing I did was last night. I went to go to a show at Come On Everybody. It's called Black Velvet. It's hosted by Bree Joy, who is a drag performer and also a tarot reader. And they are so freaking talented. They've only been in New York for a year. They came here from Atlanta, I believe. And Bree is just amazing. They are part of House of Quench, and they put on this great monthly show. So Black Velvet, check it out. It's so much fun. It was all Black trans performers, the range of performances, the creativity. It was beautiful. I loved it. There was drama. There was gore. There was fake vomit, death drops, like everything, everything you would want. Everybody wants fake vomit at a drag show. Right up top. It's a beautiful thing.
Sick.
And that was my gayest thing. Melody, what was your gayest thing?
I'm really proud of this one.
I'm proud of this one too.
Yeah, because you see my note on the doc. So you know this baby in our lives.
Yes.
We know someone, Anne. They have an adorable 16-month-old baby that is truly a star. Do you ever meet a kid and you're like, you will be famous? Like, you will either be an entertainer or the mayor, like just such a charismatic.
She's got it.
Always center of attention. She's got star power. And yesterday I was in Prospect Park with Allie and Anne and Lena, the baby. And I know Lena's an Aquarius. And every time I meet up with them, I'm like, I gotta know her big three. And I was finally with Anne so I could ask what time she was born and where. And I said before she told me, I feel like there's Aries and Leo in there somewhere. Like, I know she's an Aquarius sun, but I really feel like that's there. And then she gave me her birth time, place. I got it right. That is gay of me. She is an Aries moon and a Leo rising. Come on. Nailed it.
You know, when you were saying the star quality thing, I'm like sensing Leo rising. I'm getting so much better at astrology just through you, Melody.
By proxy.
Yeah.
Oh, I was so proud.
Love it.
That was very exciting for me.
Ellie, you're a mom. Are you into your kids' astrology?
Yeah. Do you know your kids' big three?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, their big three. No, I don't think I've looked that up. My oldest daughter is a Taurus, and she's very much a Taurus. Like, we try to get her to do really fun things. And she's always like, I prefer to be lying in my bed, draped in fleece and eating a chocolate kiss. Like, she just, and then she's really into like nurturing all of the plants in our house. You know, she's just
love it.
Such a little baby Taurus. And then she's four and my 1-year-old is a Gemini, which I also am. So I'm very excited about that, to have like a fellow gem in the house.
It's your season. Congrats. Mm-hmm. That's fun. Yeah. I don't know. Like, growing up for me, it was such like not a thing. Like, I can't remember my parents ever making any reference to my astrological sign. But I was hanging out with some straight friends, which like I do on occasion, and they have a daughter. And they kept being like, such a Virgo, such a Virgo, with everything that she was doing. And I'm like, are the straights into astrology now?
More so, for sure.
Yeah.
My straight dad loves being a Gemini, always talks about it, really bonds hard with my girlfriend who is also a Gemini, like, and it's actually scary how much they have in common. The straights are into it too. Still my gayest thing. Still very gay.
Very gay. Yes, claim it. Well, Ellie, it's your turn. Tell us, what's the gayest thing?
I mean, so this is a little bit shameful, but I'm going to share it with you guys, which I think the gayest thing I did this week is the gayest thing I have done most weeks for the last year or so, which is listen to the Pants Pod, which is,
yep. Oh, the shame, the shame,
the shame.
No, just kidding.
Every Wednesday when I'm like, on my way home from dropping my kid off at school, I'm like, it's time. It's me time with the Pants Pod.
There's no shame in that, though I haven't listened in a while. Are they still recapping episodes?
No, and I have to say, like, that's when I really got hooked, because I fucking love a good recap. I'm obsessed with it, and with the whole format, you know, and and I was really like, it was so much better than rewatching the original, just listening to their recaps. And now they're just the talking, which is nice, but it's not my preference.
I haven't listened to any of the talking episodes. So Melody and I met Kate and Leisha because they came to one of our L Word watch parties at Henrietta Hudson. And then after that, because they were like, oh, you should come on Pants and we'll come on Dyking Out, I'm like, I better start listening to Pants. So I started listening to the recaps and just like in my mind forming this narrative, like, oh, just listening to my new friends. talk about a show we both love.
That's amazing.
Casual.
Yeah. But then when they like wrapped up season one, I think I took a little break.
Yeah, me too. So they're back to talking. That means they're not recapping anymore?
No, they took a break from recapping. I think they're going to return to it.
It's a lot of work. Like when they recap, they are sitting down and like taking notes and like having to go down memory lane and like, you know, cross-reference all this stuff. So I'm sure it's a lot easier for them to talk about like landscaping and and renovations or whatever. That seems to be what they talk about.
That's like 95% of their content is like
crafting,
making iced tea, landscape design, buying a new car. It's just very relaxing to listen to.
Yeah, very LA.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's just like an LA lifestyle podcast.
Basically.
Love that.
Well, let's get to know you a little bit better. I mean, this is our first time meeting and interacting. We both would see you getting retweeted all the time on our timelines. Mm-hmm. And we're like, who is this super funny person? And then I was surprised to learn that you haven't always been a comedian. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be one of the funniest people on Twitter.
Oh, well, yeah. So my background is as a psychotherapist and a drama therapist. It's like a particular kind of creative arts therapy. And I mean, I was a writer and a performer before that. But then in my mid-20s, I had like a crisis, and I was like, had been waiting tables and bartending and trying to make being an artist work. And I was like, oh God, I need health insurance. I need money. And I went to school to become a drama therapist. And then I've done it for like since 2009. And I still do it. Like I still have a small, like a very small private practice.
So is that helping people like kind of like the artist's way, but like plus therapy, like you're helping them with creative breakthroughs? Or is it like creative people are like special and they need special help because they're problems?
It's actually neither.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I need both those other things. So but
I mean, it's actually, to be totally transparent, like mostly at this point, I just do talk therapy with the folks that I see, but I used to do a lot more drama therapy. And no, it's just, it's regular therapy, but it's using the medium of, you know, dramatic expression and play and improvisation to engage in the therapeutic process in a more like embodied, like the kind I did is basically like really intense, like therapeutic improv, but where, you know, you as a therapist are trained to engage in the play in a way that is like clinical and very therapeutic by nature. And the other person's kind of just like showing up and showing you who they are and what's going on with them and offering all this stuff, you know, about who they are into the play. And then the training kind of teaches you how to be able to like read their energy and pick up on content that's leaking out and offer it back. But instead of just being like, oh, it sounds like you are, you know, going through something about like, you know, your childhood, like you'll sort of offer that like in some kind of embodied role or scene or something like that.
Whoa, I had no idea. Melody, did you know this was a thing?
No.
Okay.
And I'm very intrigued, and I feel like
my mind is blown.
I have a lot of research to do, and I think Allie should do it.
it's very like niche, you know. It's not a field that most people know anything about.
Does it get into like role play type stuff?
Yes.
That's what I'm wondering.
So like all of a sudden you turn into someone's like dad?
Yes. But like not in the way that you might be imagining it, where
You wouldn't do my dad's accent. You would just
I might if I like know the accent. But it's not like I feel like even though most people don't know what drama therapy is, when I have these kinds of conversations with folks and then you imagine it, I think the instinct of what folks imagine is very like, okay, now I'm your dad and like tell me like all the ways that I fucked you up and like get it out and have a catharsis. And then, you know, that's very concrete. And like there's certain kinds of drama therapists that do that kind of like more straight up like role play work, but the kind that I do and did, it's more fluid than that. And it's about kind of transforming, and it's not about like story or specific like reenacting anything like that. It'd be more like if we were in a scene or like in the play, and then one of you sort of said something in improvised play that like knowing some stuff about you, like I got a feeling or an image that it was like maybe had something to do with a parental relationship or a trauma that I knew you'd gone through. Like I would offer that back, but not trying to be faithful to like a specific thing that happened or replay it, more just like, what is this content and like, what do you need to heal in it? And sort of like offering that in a more dynamic way.
That sounds like such a specialized skill set to have, to be able to do. Like there can't be that many practitioners doing it.
There's not that many. I mean, it's like I trained in this institute. The kind of drama therapy is called developmental transformations, and I trained in it for like 7 years. So it's like,
wow.
Yeah. And now I'm a comedian.
Well, I can see how that lends itself though to comedy and like performance and wow.
I mean, most people who get into it were or are actors or artists who were like, I need a career. Like, I've also always been interested in social work. So there's a lot, because you can't really be a practitioner of like an improvisationally based therapy if you can't like play, you know?
And, right.
Yeah. So it was more like I was doing something and then I like took this big detour doing therapy. And then in the last like 5 years, I recommitted and refocused to being a writer and a performer. So it was just like, there was sort of a strange little trajectory that I was on, but it's all kind of connected and like similar in terms of like what really lit me up inside about therapy and like, whether it's talk or this kind of therapy, like vulnerability, like, you know, getting to the gritty sort of stuff that you're afraid of sharing and then being able to like laugh and play with it. And like, it's the same stuff that matters to me, like in my creative work.
Were you at Groundlings or anything like that before you started that? Like, did you do improv classes?
I was just going to ask, we see that you did Second City Chicago. Was that before this?
That was when I was really young. Like I went through, I went to high school in Illinois, but I went to film school for undergrad. And then I moved to New York, to Brooklyn. And I was doing like really weird, like much more of that time, kind of like queer, like radical burlesque and like performance art. I was doing all kinds of like weird ass shit in the early aughts. And then from there is when I became a therapist. So I had really kind of left, like I hadn't done much comedy like since kind of like high school, college, you know, until I got back into it 5 years ago or something like that.
Did you go to Emerson?
I didn't. I went to BU film school. Yeah.
Oh, I was at BU.
You were?
Yeah. So when you said like film school, and I saw your tweet about yelling at your parents in the Boston Commons, which is great. And then I was like, okay, I can picture you as an Emerson girl. But did you explore the queer scene in Boston at all when you were there?
I did. Like, I didn't come out until I was 19. So like when I moved to Boston in like 1999.
Which at that time is like a very early time to come out.
It was.
Yeah,
it totally was. And yeah, I lived in Warren Towers, which, by the way, was there still a smoking section in Warren Towers when you were there?
Oh, my God. I don't think so.
There was a full on smoking room, like adjacent to the laundry room. Like, remember that big laundry room that had like a patio off of it?
Yeah.
I think about that sometimes and I'm just like, fucking 1999. Like, what the hell? That was crazy.
This is very niche content, but
very niche. I know. I'm very excited. I like never talked to anybody about this time, but yes. Yeah, so I didn't come out till I was 19. And when I was very tortured about coming out, like I had been sort of like a theater kid, like perfect daughter, eldest child, like did everything right sort of person in my childhood in high school. And then I knew my parents were not going to be supportive. And I was like, really torn up about it. So like freshman year at BU, like I was totally cosplaying as straight and, you know, did not like meet any queer people. Like I just was in a pack of like straight girls who some of them are still my really close friends. But then I kind of, you know, I remember, oh, so like, it's so of that time too. I remember like IMing people, like this one boy from like high school theater that I knew was gay and had come out because I had like stalked, you know, or wait, no, I couldn't stalk him online at that time. I don't know how I found out, but mm-hmm. I remember being like, I think I might be a lesbian, you know, and it was like, but that was the extent. And then I came out like that first summer after freshman year. And then when I came back to BU, it was so weird because I still had all the, like my, all my friends were still these like straight girls. So I didn't know what to do. And so I had like this weird double, it was very bifurcated existence. So I used to hang out at like Paperback Cafe.
Yes.
Yes. And I worked at JP Licks on Newberry Street.
Oh my God. What's that? It's like the best ice cream place. And I would go there all the time.
Yeah. And there were a lot of queers like on that street, like at Paperback, like JP Licks.
Yeah.
And then I got like, I really didn't know where to find queer people. And BU was not a very open-minded environment at that time in my experience. Yeah. And so I ended up getting it. I like became a raver. I like became a fucking candy raver, which is so shameful, more shameful than the pants pod. And that is how I met all my queer friends, was like going out to all these raves and stuff. Yeah. What about you?
So, I mean, I also want to ask you, like, Facebook came out while you were still at BU, right?
Did it?
Probably towards the end.
Oh, maybe. No, it came out the next year.
I graduated in 2003.
Yeah. So I think 2004 maybe was when it came out, because I remember it was like, oh, you could say I'm a woman interested in women and then find all the other women interested in women. And then we all started just like messaging each other. We would get each other's AIM things because there was no messenger on Facebook at the time. And
no, then a hyperlink where you could, it would lead you to AIM.
Yeah. And then we would all like communicate over, and that's how I found my network of lesbians. But I was like terrified of lesbians at the time. Like I had been out, I'd had a couple of girlfriends at that point. I was in a long distance relationship through a lot of college. So I wasn't really trying too hard to meet other queer people, but it was hard. Like I was on 14C in Warren Towers, and it was the
I was on 10C.
C Tower, the best tower.
C Tower.
It was the all women's comm floor that I was on. And I was so afraid of coming out being on this like all women's floor and being like the dyke on the floor and having everybody be like, uh-oh, watch out for her in the bathrooms and that kind of thing. And like, you know, I had a lot of friends and got along with everybody, but I know that there were like a couple people when I came out who like got weird about it, like some religious people and things were different.
Totally.
But I was kind of scared to come out in Boston. And Boston's like a weird city. Like Boston's the one place where I was always closeted at work. So when I had like internships or a work study, or I had this like part-time marketing job at one point, I was always closeted about it because it felt like everybody I worked for was so conservative. And then I moved to the South, to Atlanta afterwards, and was out immediately everywhere I worked and felt so much more comfortable being out in the South than in Boston.
Yeah.
But I feel it, like if you've lived in Boston, you understand that. You're like, it's not this like liberal utopia, but even though they were like first in gay marriage for the states and all that, like.
No, it did not feel like there was not an energy of like permission and exploration. Like it felt hard to be out at that time, especially. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You say rave scene. I'm like, wow, Boston had a rave scene. Like I've always felt uncomfortable in Boston.
It's uncomfortable.
Growing up in Connecticut and going there even for concerts and things.
Yeah, I get that. It's very racist, very homophobic.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, very racist. There's also the women's colleges there, like Simmons and Wellesley. One time I wanted to just like go to Wellesley and just see if I could. I was like so desperate to meet lesbian. I'm like, what if I just take the train to Wellesley and get off and walk around?
Totally. Oh my God. I felt that same way. And I that desperation, like,
yes.
I had a similar experience where what helped me come out actually was like, I fell in love with one of my high school best friends who was in college in Missouri. So like,
never heard that one before.
When I got back to school, like we started a relationship in my sophomore year that basically was on and off through the rest of college. So
same. Oh my God.
I didn't have that like hooking up is how you make friends that we all know and love so well. Like that's what my 20s were like later. But I was desperate. And I just was reminded when you guys were talking about the like Facebook thing. So I didn't have that. But in my desperation, I found, you know, we had like Yahoo groups at the time. And I found one called Ani Talk. And it was all people obsessed with Ani DeFranco. And we had like a whole weird like parasocial community where people were like, we felt like we were very close. It was all through our like giant desktop computers, but we would meet up and go to Ani shows. Like, but at the time it was kind of, I remember my roommates being like, you're going to meet up with strangers. Like it was very scandalous. And, but it was really important. I was just like, really desperate for any kind of community at the time.
Yeah. Like I was both desperate and terrified. Like I remember before I was out to anybody on my floor, one person who I became friends with who sings the theme song of this podcast, shout out to Callie and There Is No Mountain. Anyway, we were hanging out. This is a person I gravitated to right away. And I feel like we were just like randomly walking down the street and met somebody and they're like, oh, do you want to go to this like house party? And we're like, sure. So we follow them to a house party and it must have been an acquaintance. I don't think we would have gone with a stranger, but also I made a lot of bad decisions anyway. Before we get up the stairs, he goes, before we go up there, I just want to let you know it's all lesbians. And I like panic. And my friend is like, oh, that's great. I love lesbians. And then it was like relief. I'm like, okay, I am safe with this person.
Yeah.
She will be the first one I come out to when I do come out. And we went up and I'm just like sweating. I'm just like in the corner, like eyeing everyone. And it's just like all these like cool dykes. And I didn't talk to a single person. Just
totally.
Yeah.
Oh, those moments are so like fraught, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like they occupy such a special place in memory. Like any of those.
Yeah.
Because it feels so peak, like when it's happening, like those moments when you realize like, oh God, like this is actually going to be a safe person. It has so much weight and meaning.
Right, right. Ugh. Because a lot of people at that time, like they had never met lesbians before or like even gay people. Everyone's coming from high school where, you know, and at that time in the early aughts, like everybody was closeted in high school. So you were like a lot of people's first and sometimes only gay friend.
Yep.
So just remember that, kids, when you're really glorifying the Y2K aesthetic.
Yep.
That it wasn't all that fun.
No. Behind those yellow tinted sunglasses was oppression and anguish.
Oh my God.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Well, I could keep reminiscing about gay stuff at BU forever, but Melody, I'm not going to do that to you. So.
I'm loving listening.
Okay. What's your method of self-care for being so on Twitter?
Oh, that's good.
Because Melody and I are both, for the most part, off Twitter for mental health reasons.
And then when I go on, it ruins my day. Like yesterday, Carolyn, I sent you that extremely problematic, viral, biphobic, misogynistic tweet from a white lesbian. And it completely took up my whole morning. I spiraled out about it. I was sending it to people. I was reading all the replies to see if there was anyone who agreed with me about how horrible it was. And then I was like, wow, 3 hours have gone by. Like, this is why I don't go here.
Yeah.
You know?
What was the tweet?
Pull it up.
All right. I'll pull it up. By women with straight boyfriends who feel like you as a couple aren't welcome in queer spaces, I would simply encourage you to have a cooler boyfriend. It's a thread. Somehow, all my bisexual women friends who are dating men are dating rad men who are interesting and engaging people like we like being around. If your man is a killjoy wearing Allbirds, I don't know what to tell you, babe. It's not any deeper than that. I'm sure Kyle, digital marketing coordinator, is a sweet guy, but if we're talking about precious real estate at a packed bar during Pride weekend, he's going to have to pull his weight socially or leave. No one's owed an enthusiastic reception in any space. And then they replied again saying, this is bi erasure, in quotes. Literally, no, it isn't. Date or fuck or marry whoever you want. None of us care. We care that you throw a tantrum when you and your absolute dud of a boyfriend aren't given the red carpet rollout you want at the cool queer events. Grow up. As this gains traction in quote tweets, I'd like to remind TERFs that they're always invited to a super exclusive pride party at the bottom of the Hudson. Oh. It's like, you don't realize you're being kind of a TERF. Like, what about the quote unquote uncool guy who was at a queer sapphic maybe space who ended up transitioning? Why are you not attacking bi men with straight girlfriends? Mm. Like, why are you using the scapegoat of men to actually be misogynistic? Like, it's like, I don't know. I started reading the quote. Someone sent it to me and I was like, thanks for that.
This person has a history of like doing these takedowns of like a very specific, like Kyle with the Allbirds and working with Mark and like, you know, throwing a fit. Like, I've never heard a bisexual woman throw a fit for not feeling welcome in a queer space. The thing I hear from bi women is like their own internalized biphobia, their anxiety around being in queer spaces. And like, this stuff is why.
Exactly.
It's like these kind of tweets and tweet threads are why. And yeah, like reading that kind of stuff. And people were like, reasonably triggered by this and feeling, you know, really attacked and stuff. And like, that really messes with your mental health. You might be having a fine day, you're on Twitter, you see that, and you're like, fuck, now I'm going to be thinking about this all day. Like, how do you deal with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's, my method has shifted like over time, you know, and it's sort of the more my account has grown, like I've had to get more boundaried with myself about how I engage with Twitter, because I will tweet like what I think is the most benign, stupid, like uncontroversial tweet of all time, and people still get angry about it and act like just total garbage and are so cool. So that's like, in terms of my own tweets and how people respond, like I really try to, I feel like I've developed a kind of a radar where like, if I'm reading a few quote tweets and I can see that this is something that, you know, is, has ignited and people are jumping on the bandwagon, I, on a, like a good day, I'll just be like, that's enough of that. And I am no longer engaging with this tweet. Like, I'm not reading any comments, any quote tweets, like nothing.
Yeah.
But then sometimes I like will spiral and read them all. And I try to also like, I feel like if I can have integrity and not engage in any kind of like back and forth or being like an ass, you know, when people are being so mean, like that impulse to respond and be just as big of a dick is like really real, especially if it's triggering like deep shit. So I try to just like notice that impulse and then be like, I actually like can operate like the grown up that I am with integrity and just not say anything or say something extremely neutral, you know?
Yeah.
And then I try not to actually get too involved with other people's tweets. Like, I'm trying to just like tweet my little jokes and not spend too much time on the site otherwise.
You had a tweet very recently and I was reading the replies. Let me, as a queer and trans family, I'm feeling very nervous about taking my kids to Pride this year. And then I feel so angry because that is exactly what they want. Seeing us celebrate ourselves makes them feel scared, small, and very turned on. And I don't think they like that. And then somebody replied, don't you live in NYC? You're not going to Pride where they actually feel fear. And then you had like a nice reply. Yes, I'm grateful I live somewhere safer than many places, but that doesn't mean I still don't have a feeling of unease at this current sociocultural moment. Are you queer or trans? What the hell is the point of this response? LOL. And they write back, I am not. Straight white dude. I apologize. I was very wrong for that. And I died. I'm like, you that did feels it. Rare. You won.
No, that was like one of my favorite exchanges in those kinds of moments ever. And I don't know if you saw, like, this morning I saw his response and I responded and I just said, like, that is a real apology. Thank you. Like, there was no justification. There was no if I hurt you. It was just like,
yeah,
that was stupid. I'm sorry. It was so heartening.
Yeah.
That's wild. Yeah. That's the wildest thing on Twitter.
Yeah. He immediately saw like the ignorance of his tweet and was like, oh, damn, this is the thing that people get angry about. And I just did it.
It was great.
I should apologize. Yeah.
Good for you, dude.
Yeah. Oh, it's so real. Like, I don't have like nearly the following that you have on Twitter, but it was a point where things that I thought were very benign. Like, I remember one day I was counting out a serving size of tortilla chips, and it just felt like a very insane thing to do. Like, I looked at the bowl of like the perfectly counted chips, and I don't know. And I said, nothing makes me feel more insane than when I count out a serving size of chips to eat. And somebody was like, this is really insensitive to people with mental illness. I'm like, what? And I'm just like, delete tweet, get off Twitter, log off. Like, it was just like an immediate, I'm like, oh, this is.
You know, delete tweet is an underutilized, very helpful coping strategy because.
Oh, yeah. I delete immediately. I'm like, not worth it, not worth it.
Yeah, I wish this person deleted it instead of turning off replies.
Yeah, I used to be like, you know, I would kind of feel like a like rebellious contrarian, like I'm not deleting that tweet. Like I stand by my tweet. And I feel like a gift of having a lot of followers and having lots of things going on in my life that aren't Twitter are like, I have deleted like viral tweets where I'm just like, this is not worth, like there is no reason to keep this tweet up and just have people getting so angry and rude.
Yeah.
So just like delete that fucking viral tweet. Who cares?
Yeah. Yeah. As long as it's not something you'd want to pin, who cares?
Yeah.
So speaking of that tweet about going to Pride, I mean, it is Pride Month. You are married to a trans man. Do people like assume that you're a cis hetero couple?
Yes.
When you're out?
They really do. I've been working on like a new bit about this lately because it is such a weird thing.
Yeah.
The joke that I'm working on is about how the weirdest part about that is learning that I've learned since passing as a cis hetero couple that straight people are really nice to other straight people. And it's super weird. Like I had no idea the little like language they shared, approval and just this like,
oh man,
kindness. An unearned sort of grace. It's very weird. And I just, I don't like it. I have a hard time with that because it's fine, but I don't love, I don't love being read as cis and hetero. It's just like, not my favorite thing.
Well, maybe you could be read as bisexual and with a dud of a cis straight guy.
Yeah, I could. I hope my husband would pass the test. Damn.
Does he wear all birds? That's the question.
Yes.
Never. You know what's so funny to me about that, to go back to that for a second? Like, how many boring lesbians wear all birds and have a stupid job?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know so many boring cis marketing gay men who have no problem being welcome in these spaces, too.
Yes. Also, my wife owns a pair of Allbirds. She doesn't wear them. She works in advertising, and she's one of the coolest, most interesting people I've met in my entire life. So, whatever.
That kind of stuff is just so mean girl to me. Like, why are you shitting on people's shoes? Like, what is happening here that feels necessary? It's like
some of us like sensible footwear.
I remember saying on the podcast with Natalie Wynn, I was like, I love reading Twitter drama. And then I realize now it's like, nope, but when I'm hurt by one as a bisexual, don't love it. Don't love reading the drama. Carolyn really had to talk me down from replying in a crazy way.
Melody, so you're bi, and like, well, I'm curious because I've experienced some of this. I identify more as queer, but like sometimes we'll say bi, but I feel like I'm queer. But
right.
Regardless, like, have you encountered the mob sort of telling you that you can't call yourself a dyke or like?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. When I joined this podcast. And it's like, everyone was 19.
Yeah. Everyone who had a problem with it was like 19 and lives in England.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that it's a slur and I don't understand the history. And it's crazy because compared to their lifespan, I could be considered history myself. I'm just being ageist.
How dare you?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to do it anyways. I remember I had a canned reply I was using for a while where it was like, I've been eating pussy since you were in kindergarten. Like,
oh my God, I love that so much.
I don't know. I also did think I was a lesbian before I realized I was. Yeah, queer feels better. We did have a staunch bisexual author guest who really, I felt like pressured.
Yeah.
Remember, I said like everyone's bi or everyone's queer. And she's like, no, we're bi because if everyone is, no one is. And I felt like scared. So I started saying bi from pan. Mm. I was using pan for a while. I got hetero curious in my mid-20s. I don't know. So I was using dyke before when I thought I was hard lesbian. So it's tricky for me to even like reckon with that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like people should come after me if they have a problem with it because you're like, I'm bi. Is that okay for me being co-host of this podcast? I'm like, do I identify as a dyke? Then we're good to go. Like,
yeah.
Like, if that's.
I just point to the Dyke March about page sometimes too, and would send that because they have a very clear, like.
Inclusive.
Yeah, very inclusive, just paragraph about who's welcome there.
Oh, man.
Which includes bisexuals.
It really gets me going.
It really, yeah.
Well, like, also similar, like, when I came out as I came out as bi for 5 seconds and then I came out as a lesbian and a dyke. And it was so important for me for like years, that identity and claiming it, reclaiming it, all the blah, 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 we know. And like, like dyke was like, when I think of that word, it was so like, it represents to me like this period of really like stepping into myself and owning it and not feeling apologetic. And it's really important. So it's like, I identify with it because it's such a huge part of my history. And I didn't really, you know, like I would still call myself gay, like before I met and married my husband. And like, oof, like some of the responses I've gotten when I've said, you know, when I've referenced myself as gay, which again, like I feel more like I'm queer, but I still feel comfortable saying gay sometimes because it's just a part of my history and identity. And the response I've gotten, like these some responses where it's like, you don't even realize how much you're hurting your husband and like invalidating his identity by calling yourself a dyke. And like, that's harmful and transphobic and like all this stuff.
Like they know what your husband feels.
Like they know what he feels.
Right.
And it's like
more than you do.
Yeah. And it's like, you know what? Like my husband has an identification with his dyke history. Like, shut the fuck up. You don't know what you're talking about. It really like makes my blood boil. People policing that, the use of that word and your own identity.
Right. I do always wonder. I know a good number of people who ID as lesbians and then they'll be with someone who transitions like during the relationship and they stay with them and then have to be like, oh, can I call myself a lesbian anymore? And I'm always like, call yourself whatever feels right to you, whatever word feels like you, then use that. But I feel though that I don't know. I know that I'm very attached to the word lesbian. And if I were in that situation, I would have a struggle to be like, but that, because I'm sure some people would say, you know, since everybody's different, there could be some people that would be like, yes, I'm a man. So it's very invalidating for you to keep saying that you're a lesbian. Then I don't know.
No, totally. And Like, that is mostly what happened with me and my husband, is that, like, he hadn't started transitioning when we got together. And I did have, like, kind of like a little bit of an ego death, like kind of an existential spiral about letting go of, you know, the idea of being a lesbian and like being in a relationship. I mean, when we met, he was non-binary, so it was never a relationship with a woman. But like,
yeah,
when we decided to like really be together forever, like there was like a letting go of something. And it's so crazy to that kind of response, because it's like there's no trust that like if my husband was a trans guy who had told me like, if you call yourself a dyke, like it really hurts me, it like brings stuff up for me, like that I wouldn't attend to that or be sensitive.
Right,
like I was
right.
Like, I mean, you know, like, are we just assuming that everybody is a terrible sociopath or what?
I think that's what strangers on the internet do. They like, they assume the worst with everything you say, and they think like, oh, this person is being harmful, and they immediately go to like, you must be causing harm by expressing this opinion or using this word or using this label without taking a second to kind of interrogate, you know, what's the opposite assumption of this, you know, that like, actually this person has thought about it a lot, this is their life that they live, and mind your own fucking business.
Yeah.
That was the word hurled at me a lot for using dyke, and I know it would be hurled at me even more if I didn't happen to be with a woman for so long.
For sure. And it's like labels. We haven't had like a good labels discussion in a while, Melody, but
yeah,
it's always like they're there if they serve you, and like they're not always going to serve you. So they can change, like they mean everything and then they mean nothing. So yes, like one label could have served you for like a big portion of your life and then it no longer does. And that's not a huge deal.
But they're supposed to serve you, yet it seems like we consider almost everyone else but ourselves when we're landing on one, or like how it's going to be received by
right
the community.
Yeah. I mean, even with the word lesbian, I'm like, I'm sticking by it because I know that like people associate it with not being inclusive, but I'm an inclusive person and I'm not gonna let the non-inclusive people ruin this word for me, which is like truly how I feel, like that best describes like, you know, who I am.
And people are still using lesbian in a derogatory. I was in a Nordstrom Rack yesterday, okay? And there were two girls in another aisle next to the one I was in, and they were trying to decide if they should get these clogs, and they were just like, I don't know, these are lesbian shoes, I don't know if I should get them, like they're really lesbian, do you think they're lesbian, like I can't. I was like transported back to middle school.
I mean, that's part of the reason for me why like I like that word. It is that reclaiming of it. I'm like, yeah, a lesbian, it's not, there's no shame.
Yeah.
Well, are you going to go to Pride with your trans queer family?
I think so. I think we'll go, you know, Pride is so funny with little kids. You know, there's like specific periods of time during the day that we can even like all go and nobody's napping and stuff.
Right.
Such as like being a queer elderish person. But yeah, I think we're going to like do some Brooklyn Pride, at least like wandering around. So my older kid especially can kind of experience that. And like, she's obsessed with drag queens right now. Do you guys know the Little Miss Hot Messes books, the drag queen books?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I didn't know what they were called. Thank you for that. I want to get that for my girlfriend's niece.
Oh, you really should. So it's like the new one. That person is a friend of mine from like years ago in San Francisco. And so he sent me the books, and my daughter became obsessed with this like one drag queen in the books called Peanut Butter Jelly. And she like was so like, she was like, I want to meet Peanut Butter Jelly. Like, how can we make that happen? Like, where is she performing? I've got to meet her. And I like messaged my friend and I was like, is that a real queen that we can like watch a video of or something? And then he sent her a video back, like in full drag, being like, I made her up. She's just a fictional character, but like, I love it. And like, love you, Goldie. It was like the cutest thing that ever happened. So I want her to maybe see some queens in real life. So I think we're going to head out at some point.
I have pictures of me as a kid, like gawking at drag queens.
Yes. So much fun.
Yes.
And I still do.
Me too. I love them so much.
Well, we have to wrap up, unfortunately, but there is one question we want to ask you.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about queer culture, but what is one thing from straight culture that you would like to appropriate?
I'm going to tell you guys, I have appropriated it, and it's being a fucking mom and dad in my family. I'm a full-on mommy, daddy, two kids family, and we are like the queerest, transest family ever, and I just fucking love that so much.
Oh, hell yeah. Just taking up space at the playground.
That's right. That's right. It's great, and it's a little, contains a little gem. Like, every time, you know, my kid is just kind of like, my mommy and daddy, like, I just have like a little glimmer of fun about the fact that she doesn't really get at this point, like, how much we have queered that. And
yeah.
It just, it's great. It's just what it is. Like, it's not intentional, but I love it.
Beautiful.
Do you live in Brooklyn?
I do.
So, yeah. Are you familiar with the Brooklyn mommies?
Yes.
At the park. And
yeah.
I just love the idea of your family right smack dab in the middle of that.
Oh, yeah, it's weird.
I was at a Prospect Park music circle for kids. I mean, not even two yet, wandering around, but expected to learn all these colors concepts through song. Yeah. And we need more queer trans Brooklyn mommy daddies in there.
Yes. Yes. Oh, dear Lord. I'm always sort of looking out to see if I can spy. It's like Brooklyn. Like, you would think that there would just be a preponderance of queer and queer and trans parents in the playground. But, you know, there's not. It's still just a lot of cis folks. And
it really is.
Straight folks. And so I'm always having my eye out.
Yeah. That is funny. Whenever I see like a big group of like parents and toddlers, it's always very straight looking. But then when I'm walking through Park Slope, it's a lot of queer parents with their kids individually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We need to corral them together.
Or queer nannies.
Yeah, or queer nannies.
A lot of that.
Lots of young queer nannies. Yeah. Yep. I have a thing that happens a lot where I'm out with my kids and people think I'm the nanny. Like, that has happened so many times.
Yeah, big nanny energy.
Nanny energy.
AKA cool haircut.
Yeah.
AKA dewy complexion. Yeah. I feel like it does. It gives me a little boost. I'm like, I know, but I like that you think that. Also, it says something about, like, at the playground at, like, 3 p.m., there's a noticeable paucity of parents there. Like, it's a lot of nanny action at that time. So that's another piece of it, I think.
Yeah.
Where can people follow and nice reply only to you on Twitter and Instagram and all that?
Yeah, just at Ellie Kremendahl, just my name. And same, my website is just my name as well.
Well, it was so fun meeting you and diking out and talking about the good old carrier days.
Yeah, it was so fun. Thank you both so much for having me. It was a blast.
Yes. And you can follow us at Diking Out. You can follow me at TGI Carolyn.
You can follow me at Melody Kamali.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
See you next Tuesday.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season 1 was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to Season 1, we are thrilled to announce the launch of Season 2. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make Season 2 even more memorable together.